Great. Hi, everybody. I'm going to talk for about 45 minutes, 50 minutes, and then we'll do questions at the end. Okay. So, the legacy of the Crusades. I'm sort of by trade and by training, I suppose, a medieval historian. That's what I studied at undergraduate, and that's what I did my PhD in. But in a sense, I suppose history has caught up with us to some extent, because, of course, the idea and the word Crusade appears more and more in everyday political dialogue. I suppose it jumped up. I'm sorry to worry. It's not a good start, is it? But anyway, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, in the aftermath of 9/11, George Bush described the Crusade War on Terror as going to take a long time. He was off script at that particular moment. You could hear the slap of his advisors' hands against their faces as they thought, "Oh my lord, how are we going to deal with this?" Because, of course, he'd taken rather little note of the Middle East down to that point. For me, where I got interested in the legacy of the Crusades, well, apart, in a sense, the Bush thing triggered it to some extent, in part was that, well, without making too high a comparison, St. Paul on the road to Damascus had his conversion. I had my conversion on a road in Damascus. When I was out running one morning in Damascus at a conference, and I saw a poster for Saladin the Ballet. Who could resist Saladin the Ballet? Very easily after you've watched it is the short answer. I've never been to a ballet before, and I don't think they're like this, really. But the point was, this was in downtown Damascus, in the big theatre in Damascus, where Assad still makes various speeches. And this was put on, you know, as a focal cultural event in Damascus in 2009. And so in the course of it, it was the first night press, media were there. Speeches, denunciations of Israel, and then the ballet itself, which had Saladin defeating the drunken Westerners at the Battle of Hattin, and then recovering Jerusalem. And by the end of it, everybody's clapping along. We all know no surprises in the storyline, of course, and what everybody would like to happen has happened. And then the sort of nil-nil draw of the Third Crusade is parked and not looked at. So really my thought was, why, how have we got, not why, because I think it's fairly obvious why that was being shown in downtown Damascus, but how have we got to the point where Saladin's legacy is so live? How has his legacy endured down the centuries? How evenly has that happened? So really, I suppose we're looking at an idea that has endured for 800 odd years. And how has it resonated so powerfully? That's the question that I'm really asking today. I suppose you've got to begin to answer that by wondering what a crusade actually was. And here it has to be said that the answer isn't simple. Historians have proven energetic, if rather divergent in their views. But just in a sense to sort of encapsulate where I think it is very, very simply. 1095, Pope Urban II says that whoever for devotion alone, not for honour nor money, goes to Jerusalem to liberate the holy city will receive remission of all their penance, of all their sins, crudely. So in other words, it's a focus on Jerusalem for devotion alone. The fact that he says not for honour nor money makes me think people are going for honour and money, but that's a slightly different story. So it's a Jerusalem-focused event. Fairly quickly, crusading diversifies, and you get crusading in Iberia, recapturing the Iberian Peninsula from the Spanish Muslims. Crusading diversifies to include expeditions against the pagans of the Baltic. And then when you get into the 13th century, you have crusades against the Cathar heretics of southern France. So you see it's a flexible concept. The enemies of the church is something that can be molded and manipulated in the 12th and the 13th centuries according to the needs of the people and the place at the time. You have crusades against enemies of the church, and they can be Catholics. Frederick II of Germany, Stupor Mundi, the wonder of the world, who gets Jerusalem back by negotiation, was excommunicate at the time. There's a crusade against him later on. Crusades against the Mongols. Okay, so you get the picture. It's a flexible concept. And even in 1291, when the Franks are forced out of the Holy Land, that is not the end of the Crusades, as again, perhaps used to be held very traditionally. Crusading goes on. The 14th, 15th, 16th centuries, crusading obviously against the Ottomans, for example. Crusading ideas with Columbus, and then you get obviously the rise of Protestant powers too. And so this all begins to bring the Crusade into challenge and perhaps into disrepute in some ways. I think you have to say that the idea is in decline by the time you get to the 16th, 17th century. So say the rise of Protestantism, the Enlightenment is pretty scathing about the Crusades. The only thing it brought to Europe was leprosy, etc., etc. So that, I suppose, marks a consensus of when the real, inverted commas, crusading had kind of run out of steam. However, when I've been trying to answer my question how the Crusades survived and endured, if you start looking at the 19th century, you do see a fairly remarkable resurgence and revival in the use of the idea of the Crusade. Largely, it has to be said as a metaphor. And it's used with divergent meanings according to context and user. So to a 19th century Frenchman in the Near East, it's part of his legacy. The Crusaders were here in the 12th century. We, the French, are back in the 19th century. And here we have this rather fine man here. He's in a hospice. This is in a hospice in Jerusalem. And this is a working hospice. You walk into it. Well, you don't walk into it now. You have to ask politely. And the wall, it's absolutely amazing. The wall, about the size of that, is covered with Crusader shields. And that's the French representing themselves in the 19th century. So you walk in that hospice today, and that's still there. Crusading has survived. Obviously, I showed you George Bush. Another example of it down the 19th, 20th century, of course, is Nasser. And I'll talk about him in a little bit. Other people who've thought about the Crusades down the centuries, 19th century Egyptians, much more up to date. Of course, ISIS, IS. This is the IS newsletter of March, the failed Crusade. Another way in which the Crusades' legacy survives today, and this is not another pleasant one, I'm afraid, Arabia. I suppose we think of Crusades in a modern sense. We think of Al-Qaeda, Bin Laden, IS. You've got to remember the right wing as well, extreme right wing. So I'm told a friend of mine was in Prague the other month, and there are men dressed as Crusaders in some of these far-right rallies. So, and Breivik. So don't forget that side of it. It's all bad, but just you need to have that dimension too. Another example, actually, one of my students did this, Mexican drugs cartel. You know, there was that Mexican guy, the Mexican drugs bloke, that they all said they'd shot, and in fact he wasn't dead. Well, his organization's rule is basically a rip-off of the Knights Templar rule from the 1130s. It is remarkably taken, almost word for word. So somebody in Mexico is using Bernard of Clairvaux's In Praise of the New Knighthood to write the rule book for a Mexican drugs cartel in the early 21st century. So you can see this subject has got many kind of... There's a lot of evidence you can use to try and see how the Crusades are remembered in all sorts of different ways, at all sorts of different levels. Sometimes it's incredibly superficial. The word is just used. But sometimes it's got a deeper understanding. Literature, educational works, visual sources, academic historiography, drama, music, opera, political, religious texts, ceremonies and performances. I mean, crusading has been used at popular mass culture levels, as well as in carefully framed ideological moments. Of course, those aren't mutually exclusive. It can also be employed to entertain, inspire, inflame, educate, misinform, and provoke. At root, of course, it's a matter of cultural memory. And in some senses, all of these studies are indebted to, consciously or not, the issue of memory as a subject in and of itself. And Paul Connaughton, for example, has written that social memory in particular, concerning social memory in particular, we may note that images of the past commonly legitimate a present social order. Our experience of the past very largely depends upon our knowledge of the past. Past factors tend to influence or distort our experience of the present. And the Crusades are a reference point. Let's get rid of him, sorry. I deliberately had another slide after that, and I forgot to do it because you don't want to look at him for any longer than you need to. The Crusades are a reference point, which by nature of their origins as a divinely sanctioned holy war, hold and assume a higher moral cause. For those in favour of the principle or goals pertaining to a particular struggle, or if they derive benefit from the outcome of such a conflict, then crusading is something that individuals, institutions and cultures can continue to invoke in a positive way or as a positive force. Conversely, for those in opposition to or on the receiving end of a crusade, inverted commas, especially those in different religious and or cultural contexts, it's possible to invoke their own spiritual or religious principles to inspire resistance. And even filleted of their most strict definitional aspect, that is the papal appeal and the remission of sins, the notion of collective endeavour of a positive moral value can be remarkably alluring as a rallying call. It can then be employed in a conflict situation where opponents are seen to be inevitably in the moral wrong. World War I is an example, you will find it, not just in the Middle East, but in the trenches. There's a whole literature emerging on crusade imagery in World War I, with Anglican chaplains invoking it. Crusading can be a metaphor for noble causes, or causes claimed as noble, depending which way you want to see it. Secular context shorn of any military or religious resonance. One that I came across recently, 1965, Harold Wilson said, quote, "The Labour Party is a moral crusade or it is nothing." So in terms of a moral crusade. Numerous efforts to improve health or the environment are labelled crusades. I tell my students, go to the Daily Mail online and go to the Guardian online and type in the word crusade, and you will find a lot of recent examples of them. The most popular one recently is how the Young Royals on crusading for mental health for young people. The word is being applied in that sort of superficial way there very frequently. So crusading has a special resonance and power. A blend of its extensive and long-lasting political, religious, economic and social impact in the West meant that it was there to be used when the context presented itself. In other words, the longevity of crusading, in part a function of its flexibility and diversity, as I outlined above, while maintained at different levels of intensity between the West and the Near East, kept the idea in play. And when, as I say, you go back to the 19th century, political events began to unfold there, it's in the collective memory of the West and the Near East. And I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about the Near East. And from the perspective of the modern Near East, a blend of factors seemed appropriate from the 19th century onwards. Western aggression and invasions, loss of life, land and freedom. And secondly, you need to look back, or they were keen to look back to the Crusades or the era of Saladin to see what had happened there, because, of course, the Westerners were defeated. So, Saladin is the man to look at. And Saladin was the man who drew together the Muslim Near East in an incredibly fragile confederation in the 1160s, the 1170s. To my mind, that was his greatest achievement. Saladin, I suppose, is held up as the man who recovered Jerusalem in 1187. But you think about trying to draw together Egypt, Syria, Iraq, using modern place names. Culturally, religiously, historically, politically, economically, linguistically. Give it a go. Well, it's very, very hard. And I suppose historians have rather glibly used the phrase, and I notice I used to do so, Saladin unified the Muslim world. Well, that's just cobblers. Because the Muslim world is much bigger than that, of course, and he did not really unify it. He assembled a very, very fragile confederation, briefly. But anyway, even to make that juggling trick work, I think, was quite remarkable. And then, having assembled this fragile coalition, in 1187, he defeated the Franks at the Battle of Hattin. This is the true cross, being humiliated at the Battle of Hattin, as is a play at the Globe. It was a couple of years ago. And you can see the defeated King of Jerusalem on the right, and this is Reynald of Châtillon, the walk-on baddie, about to be executed. And then, of course, when Saladin captured Jerusalem shortly after that, the thing that he did was to free the Christian prisoners afterwards. And this act of not slaughtering the defenders of Jerusalem in the way that the First Crusade had massacred the Muslim defenders of Jerusalem in 1099, I think, is the sort of transformational event that is one of the things that brought him, certainly into the Western historical eye, to a level that was really sort of sealed his fame and the admiration of the West down to the present day. The fact that he chose to show mercy, there's a complicated story as to why he did it, but that, we needn't worry about that. The fact that he did not kill the prisoners in Jerusalem, I think, is what's remarkable. So, he's there to be admired, and you can use that example of drawing the Near East together and defeating the West to be an inspiration in the more recent period. So, jumping right down to the present, oh yeah, there's Richard the Lionheart, of course, who we saw off in the Third Crusade as well. Right, so to jump down to the modern day again. So where is Saladin being used in the modern day? And then I'm going to sort of trace that back a little bit. Well, one example, I suppose I showed you the ballet in Damascus. Well, if you missed the ballet in Damascus in 2009, there was the musical in Lebanon in 2010, complete with horses, live horses, AK-47s. Here Saladin was making peace. So he's used in a different way, and I think this is the key. To, in a sense, if you're following him through as well as the Crusades, it's his flexibility as a character and an individual. So he's making peace there. Where else has he been used? Ah, yes, the cartoon. Has anybody seen this?
Yeah.
Okay, good. This is Malaysian television, and I'll read from this. An action-adventure series, Saladin has everything the target audience of 10 to 15-year-olds want. Heroes, villains, vendettas, drama, comedy, exotic locales, daring rescues and a dash of romance. I think she's there on the right. Saladin is the ultimate hero, courageous in the face of danger, never willing to admit defeat, and funny when he needs to be. I haven't found that in the sources, I have to tell you. In a world of danger, there's only one man you'll want in your corner, Saladin. So, here, 10 to 15-year-olds in 21st century Malaysia, this is Al Jazeera as well, it's in Arabic, there's an English subtitled version. You can all go home and find it on the internet. Saladin the cartoon. It's about 12 episodes. My students faithfully watch them. I've got through 1.5. You can see he's very Western in his styling, actually. But here, you know, that blurb, that was the official blurb that I read you there from the website. And he's there not as the man who defeated the Westerners and recovered Jerusalem. He's there because of his character. So he's there as somebody who's survived down the centuries because he is a great man, a great ruler, with attributes of loyalty, chivalry, generosity, humility. So he's endured for that reason too, which I think is interesting. So that's very recent. Equally, Erdogan opens the Saladin Airport in Turkey's restive southeast. Well, if you want to go to tick that box, so the Saladin Airport in southern eastern Turkey. But the airport would be named for Saladin to remember the 12th century founder who led Muslim resistance against the Christian crusaders. He's a Kurd. We are naming this airport Saladin Ayyubi to send a message of solidarity and brotherhood to say Jerusalem belongs to Kurds, Turks, Arabs and Muslims forever. Mm-hmm. You can start disentangling Erdogan and Kurds, etc., etc., at your leisure. But this is, I think it's 18 months ago, this. So the politicised use of him, you know, clearly there is a big message to different parties going out here. Right. So I hope you get the point that he is in current use. Now, how do we get there? Well, academically speaking, the consensus had been until fairly recently that the Muslim world forgot about Saladin and the Crusades until 1898, when the Kaiser went to visit the Ottoman Empire. This is the dying days of the Ottoman Empire, and Kaiser Wilhelm goes on his trip to the Near East. He went with Thomas Cook's, and people rather took the mickey out of him for this, called him Cook's Crusader, and I think some Germans wrote satirical poems, so he had them imprisoned. The emperor, I can be a bit harsh on people if they take the mickey out of me. It was an incredible sort of entourage went with him. He went to Jerusalem, where he had a huge hole knocked in the walls and dressed as a crusader and went into Jerusalem. He then turned a very clever trick because 2 weeks later he went to Damascus. And there he went to Saladin's tomb. The one on the right is the early 13th century one. Saladin died in 1193, that's the early 13th century one. This on the left looks like it should be in Frogmore or somewhere like that. Actually, it's Ottoman from the 1870s, which at the very least tells you that if the Ottomans were building a second tomb for Saladin in the 1870s, they were interested in it then. Why else would you do it? The Kaiser laid a wreath on Saladin's tomb, saying from one great ruler to another, modestly. Lawrence of Arabia nicked it, and it's now in the Imperial War Museum. But and then there was a great big dinner. And fortunately, our man at the Foreign Office was there to write it all down for historians like me later. And here you have, this is the Kaiser's speech. I remember that I am now in a city in which once lived the greatest prince who is recorded in history, the valorous hero who by his did courage, his elevation and ability of character, and his devotion to his religion was an example in heroism even to his enemies. I refer to the Sultan Saladin of the dynasty of Ayyub when I think of this. So this is the Kaiser. Obviously, in a sense, he's praising his hosts, but he is calling Saladin out again as a great man in history. And as I say, historians, starting with a German writer called Werner Ender in 1984, followed by Carol Hillenbrand in 1999, have sort of said, well, this is the Kaiser reminding the Muslim Near East that the Crusades were important, that Saladin was an important figure. They argue this because there is no word for Crusaders in Arabic until the mid-19th century. There's some debate about that, I have to say. There's no biography of Saladin, one written in Turkish in 1872, or a Muslim-penned history of the subject in 1898. So that's the sort of the argument in favour of that. I don't know, it just didn't feel right. They'd forgotten about Saladin and the Crusades. I wasn't convinced by it. And that's not a very intellectual thought process, is it? But it just didn't feel right that you forget this sort of thing. So, I don't have Arabic and I don't have Turkish. But on the other hand, I know some places to look. And if you start then going back through the sort of historical record down the centuries, you can start building up a considerable body of evidence to see that Saladin and the Crusades and the history of the Near East is reported in that area and has resonated down through time. You can look in the 13th, 14th century. The other argument, against the sort of removal, as it were, of Saladin and the Crusades is that Saladin's dynasty, the Ayyubids, was effectively removed from power in 1250, replaced by the Mamluk dynasty and Baibars. So, in other words, you don't go around saying how great the previous lot were when you've done them away. And so, therefore, this sort of Saladin was kind of parked for that reason. The Mamluks were then later taken over by the Ottomans. And so the same example, you know, again, why talk about a hero from another group? It doesn't hold up, actually. But you can look at through 14th, 15th century documents, things like documents, poems, documents about jihad, documents in praise of the merits of Jerusalem. And they talk about the struggle with the Crusaders, and Saladin gets mentioned, of course, as the man who recovered Jerusalem. So he's there in that kind of historical record. Local histories of Jerusalem and Hebron. There's one written by a man called Mujahideen in the early 16th century, widely copied and circulated. You start looking for the number of surviving manuscripts of this thing, and people are circulating these texts. That one talks quite a lot about Saladin. But of course, the main thing going on, I'm not sure we can try and read that now, is a conflict with the Ottomans. And while I suppose the Ottomans are pushing into Europe quite a lot at this time, there are also moments when it looks as if the West is sort of pushing back the other way. And you can see that in 1614, British diplomats in Istanbul reported a fear amongst the Syrians that there was an imminent attack coming from the West. It's the Medici Duke of Tuscany who's going to lead the Order of St. Stephen, a military order from the 16th century. And there's great fear that there is going to be another crusade. And in 1621, the appointment of a French consul to Jerusalem produced a petition to the Sultan. Our city is a place which the infidels look at with covetous eyes. We fear lest they occupy us, as happened again several times before. So they always cast back to what happened in the past. They're here again. And that's the sort of the button that is being pressed. And they say, look, you know, you really have got to do something. They're looking to Istanbul to try and sort of stamp this kind of thing out. So you have evidence of that nature too. You have also some sort of more kind of localized evidence. There's a poem written in Jerusalem in the early 17th century, a poem for public recitation concerning struggle for... This is just out the back of the Holy Sepulchre. It's a waqf, a religious dedication. It's a big complex And there's a poem written in the 17th century about the ownership, an ownership dispute over it. And the local sheikh wrote about it, a poem for public recitation, and it's Saladin who's set there as the man who founded this back in the 12th century. Look to the Khanqah erected in the cause of our faith by the hand of the righteous Saladin, the high-minded one. By him I mean the deceased king. May God's pleasure with him increase, he who saved Jerusalem from godliness and injustice. He founded it as an abode for the righteous Sufi masters from the world over, Arabs and non-Arabs. So Saladin's clearly a fairly familiar historical figure to be sort of cited in such a way. He's mentioned in the Turkish travel writer, Çelebi, and you also find Western writers, when they start visiting the Holy Land, talk about Saladin and the locals referring to Saladin, the Crusaders, and Hatim. I could then give you a number of examples about that. But I think the most important one that I would mention, because of time, is an Ottoman historian called Mustafa Naimah, who wrote between 1665 and 1716. He lived between 1665 and 1716. And around his time, of course, the Ottomans are fighting the Austrians and the Russians. So that's the contemporary conflict at the time. And he is trying to say that there have been wars against Westerners in the past. There have also been peace agreements with Westerners in the past. He's trying to soften up his own people for the idea of making a peace with Westerners, saying it's not entirely shameful. It has happened before. And so he looks at that. But he also talks about Saladin as an exemplar for contemporary views. It's the truth that he served religion and the state in a way which has been granted to few other kings. Books of history are overflowing with honour and praise for that noble individual. Casual statement, books of history are overflowing. This is in Istanbul in the 17th century. It's just there, and there's loads of it. And I think that's a really interesting throwaway line, that this man is kind of in common currency in the sort of capital of the Ottoman Empire. He also again talks about Saladin as a great ruler, a great man. It's not just the military stuff. And I think that's interesting as well. But at the end of the 17th century, at the end of the 18th century, you have a major change in relations between the Near East and the West. And that's Napoleon's invasion of Egypt. And this is where I would really say that gears change. And with Napoleon's invasion of Egypt, you have European involvement in the Mediterranean stepping up several gears, or in that area and subsequently. The French, when they're going to invade the land, well, Napoleon says, I'm definitely not a crusader, and I like Muslims a lot, because I've just conquered Malta, the home of the Knights of St. John, the Hospitallers, so you can tell that the fact that I've just conquered the Crusader Island, that I'm definitely not anti-Muslim. And I'm sure Napoleon, in a sense, they admired Islam. And the problem was that most of the locals didn't believe him. In Egypt, they, of course, viewed the French invaders with great suspicion. Not least because some of the other people in Napoleon's army described themselves as crusaders and following in crusaders' footsteps. But if you look at some of the writings of Egyptian scholars at this time, there's a writer, a very important writer, Al-Jabati. He's the first sort of modern historian of Egypt, Al-Jabati. And he talks endlessly about the French as being untrustworthy in their promises. He mentions holy war. He mentions Egypt being saved by a man called Yusuf. In this case, it's Yusuf Zia Pasha. Egypt has been saved by a Yusuf in the past. And Saladin's real name, of course, was Yusuf. So he's looking back to him as the man who's rescued it. Another eyewitness to the French invasion was a man called Nicholas the Turk. And he's very interesting. He just says, well, the Egyptians are never going to work with the French. We don't like the different religion. We don't like their language. We don't like their clothes. And also there's the old enmity which has been between us and the French. And it goes back to the time of the Sultan Baybars in the 13th century. And the French King Louis was made prisoner at Mansoura. So he simply looks back to the previous French invasion of Egypt in 1250 and says, their king was captured, it's going to happen again, we don't like them. It's just this straight line that's drawn through, and I think that's really very, very telling. It's there in the cultural legacy of these people. There's some other evidence you can look at to see the impact of the French invasion. There's a source, again, I don't have Arabic, but I have a good friend who does. Sijil records, which are the archives of Sharia courts. You can look at those for Jaffa and Haifa and places like that. And they talk about the danger facing Islam, the duty of Muslims to fight the invaders, your duty to encounter the cursed French infidels, may God destroy them all. You see the language that's being used to describe the French invaders is pretty strong. It does have to be said that in the course of the 19th century, the Westerners do, when they start having a greater presence in the Near East, in a sense, add fuel to the fire, by in a sense, representing themselves as crusaders. I said crusading in the West had kind of fallen into disrepute, but at the start of the 19th century, you've got the Romantic movement coming in, novels of Walter Scott, Ivanhoe, The Talisman, and things like that, which are incredibly popular. The Talisman is translated into multiple languages, and so is Ivanhoe. You couldn't move for the damn thing. And there's pageants and paintings and all sorts of stuff. And you think of Windsor Castle. Most of Windsor Castle you see is early 19th century in terms of wanting to rebuild a sort of medieval style. And so there is an enormous sort of cultural looking back to the medieval period that hasn't happened for centuries. And crusading is a part of that. And then when you get people going to the Holy Land and a Western presence in Jerusalem, that, I guess, Westerners presenting themselves as crusaders will make the locals think of it even more clearly. This is this hospice I was talking about. And you can see, that's just a part of it. And these shields. And I reckon these shields, there's a good little project here for somebody. There's also in France, this isn't just in Britain, this happens in France, at the Salle des Croisades in Versailles, Palace of Versailles. There are the crusading rooms are unveiled in the mid-19th century. And they have to be shut after a couple of weeks because there's a fight, because not enough people have got their names on the wall. People are angry that they are not being represented as having crusading ancestors in France in the mid-19th century. And there's a little side story, there's a forger, a master forger, who if you said you wanted to prove your crusading ancestry, I said, don't worry, sir. I know the archive that I can find the document in. He was coming up with these forged Genoese charters. And they weren't found out for about 80 years. Brilliant. So some families were sort of, but you see the point, families are wanting to trade on their crusading ancestry in 19th century France. So rather than being this sort of disreputable, rather crass, foolish idea of the earlier period, it's got some momentum. And sorry, the rambling excursus is that I reckon those shields are the same as they were going to be the ones in Versailles, but I don't know that. So there is a sort of sense of self-representation that is not helping. That's St. Louis, and that's the hospice. And they also covered it in shields from the 12th century again behind it. Franz Joseph of Austria goes to Jerusalem in the mid-19th century, and oops, he's crusader. So that's in the Austrian hostel. Great pastries if you're in the old city of Jerusalem. And later on, this is the Kaiser's modest building that he constructs on top of the Mount of Olives, where it's the most amazing sort of fake 12th century church you've ever seen inside. It's absolutely colossal. Christ just about gets a look in. A distant second, I'm afraid, to you-know-who. But also, again, lots of crusading kings there. So a strong element of self-representation. However, there's sources from the Muslim side of things too, which I probably haven't got time to go into. But the one I would like to say, actually, just to give you one of them, is the first Muslim first Lebanese newspaper comes out in the 1870s, and in it serializes a story called The Two Gardens by Abu Shama. Abu Shama was a 13th century Muslim chronicler, the two gardens, one is a man called Nuruddin, who was Saladin's boss, and the other is Saladin. So a newspaper serialises the life of Saladin. Newspaper proprietors don't serialise stuff their readers don't want and don't know about. So you can see that this is something that the newspaper man reckons is of interest to his audience. We also have things like some of the 12th, 13th century texts are produced in print for the first time. They've survived in multiple manuscripts. People are printing the medieval texts for wider circulation. So I think this again sort of shows a long-standing interest in Crusader. Okay, we then get up to the Kaiser in 1898. So I hope I've sort of, in that rather swift way, shown you that there is some kind of backlife to this interest in Saladin and the Crusades. But when you get into the early 20th century, of course, you've got Arab nationalism beginning to come on strong. You've got the emergence of the Zionists and that whole sort of tension with the breakdown of the Ottoman Empire. And again, the Crusades and the history of the Near East start being brought through and through and through. And this is an incident in 1911. You can see some people are selling lands to the Zionists. And there is this is a castle that Saladin captured. And this is a sort of very crude stereotype of a Jew here, sort of, and then Saladin and the castle. And the caption reads, Saladin says, "Keep away from this fortress, you swindler, or else I shall set upon you the armies of my descendants, and you will not come near a fortress which I conquered with Muslim blood." He says, "I don't care, we've got lots of money." And they actually, there's more to it. And again, they cite Ibn al-Athir, the 13th century Aleppan chronicler in this. So they are bringing forward historical sources, real medieval sources, to adduce their case. When you get to the First World War, of course, you've got Allenby ending up in Jerusalem in 1917. And you've got the obvious link between, you know, the first Western ruler of Jerusalem since the time of the Crusades. A lot of people wanted to connect Allenby with the crusading movement. He, of course, said, "You might want to notice that 2/3 of my army is Muslim. A lot of Muslim regiments in my force, so perhaps this is a button we shouldn't be pressing." And the government issues a D notice banning mention of the Crusades in connection with Allenby. It fails abysmally. In fact, they start calling it a crusade fairly soon in some of their information films, but that's by the by. You get further references to it, certainly in the discussions about Syria, the Sykes-Picot, Lawrence of Arabia, around that quite a lot. But it really, more interestingly perhaps, or less obviously, would be a better way of putting it, you see Saladin and the Crusades starting to emerge in drama and literature. You start looking at early Arab drama late 19th, early 20th century, and there are plays about Saladin and the Crusades there. There are novels. This is pretty awful, I have to say. I have read it, so you needn't detain yourself with that. There's encyclopedias and reference works. This is there's also the Saladin University in Jerusalem, briefly there. This is sort of like the Royal Holloway University of London logo. This is the Saladin University logo from this university set up in Jerusalem before Allenby took it, actually. So you see there's a broader sort of cultural resonance of crusading and Saladin moving through in the early 20th century. The political thing, I suppose, there's this document called The First Call. This is from the National Archives in 1919. Again, looking back to the defence of Palestine, safeguard the land of your forefathers who defended her from the offence of the Crusaders in the days of Saladin, and linking the foundation of Israel, or the Zionist movement with that. So you can see that's a fairly toxic mix, potentially. Trying to call the Arabs to action. And again, this is the Foreign Office, helpfully for people, idiots like me, provide translations of synopses in English of Arab newspapers every week in the early 20th century, sent over to our chaps to help them understand what's going on. So you have that. Then when you move through into the post-World War II period, I'm aware I've got to keep an eye on the clock here, you find some more mainstream Arab nationalist leaders beginning to invoke Saladin and the Crusades a lot more openly and a lot more powerfully. Nasser, the Suez conflict, was an obvious example of that. Nasser was very interested in Saladin, not least because Saladin drew together Syria and Egypt. 1958, I think, United Arab Emirates? No, no, UAR, United Arab Republic, Syria and Egypt. Lasted 2 or 3 years. Nasser goes to Saladin's tomb, mentions Saladin a lot in his speeches, mentions the defeat of the Crusaders a lot in his speeches, cites 12th, 13th century sources in his speeches, sometimes gets things exaggeratedly wrong, like we captured Richard the Lionheart, which didn't happen, but again, he's using historical sources to buttress that. Again, Nasser's speeches were translated into English by the government of the day, by the Egyptian government, and are accessible if you want to read them. But again, a wider commemoration of this with Nasser. These are a set of Egyptian postage stamps. Great moments in Egyptian history. I'm not too sure about the top one, 1500 BC. This is the capture of Louis IX in Mansoura in 1250 that they were mentioning back in the Napoleonic invasion. This is Louis being led in chains through the streets of Mansoura. Top right, Saladin in the Battle of Hattin. This is the defeat of the Mongols in 1260, very important. And then we go down to the 1950s. So it's there. If you sent a postcard to France with those stamps on it, it's torn up. And then, if you have 2.5 hours of your life, has anybody seen this?
No.
Oh, you should watch it. With care, with a friend. There's a lot of shouting. There's 8 battles in 2.5 hours. It's utterly brilliant. It's the worst prosthetics you've seen in your life. Some pretty grim acting. Amazing, like, 1960s cinematography with split screens and spinning things with blood flying off them. It's absolutely entrancing. But it's also a party political for Arab nationalism. Straight down the line, Arab nationalism. And in it, Saladin talks to Richard. Of course, in reality, they never met. Jerusalem is ours. Just be clear. Jerusalem is ours. You can. We mean peace. You can come here in peace. But it's ours. It's a very Arab. There's a lot of Christians, you know, in the film. So Arab nationalism in that very strong sense of Muslims and Christians working together as Arabs. It's a really, really powerful, powerful piece of Arab nationalism. There's a little bit of religion in it, a little bit, but not too much. Other people who've used Saladin and the Crusades in modern times, moving perhaps into more familiar territory. Actually, interesting, just one other Nasser thing. Of course, some of his military expeditions were less successful towards the end of his life, and there's actually a play written about Saladin which uses Saladin as a way of showing that Nasser had been a failure in some of his, he's set up as something for Nasser to fail against, which I think is quite interesting. Not popularly circulated, but there. The Assad dynasty have used Saladin a lot. Apparently in Assad's palace, there is a big wall painting in which Saladin rise to victory against the Westerners. Jimmy Carter saw it, Henry Kissinger saw it, and Hafiz al-Assad, the father of the current dictator, would sort of show them the picture, take them through what happened, and they both said, well, kind of wasn't really worth talking much after that. That was how he saw it, that's how it was going to happen. He did have this equestrian statue put up. I don't know whether that's still there now, but I suspect the statue may be just outside the citadel of Damascus. And here you have holy men, a warrior, and a Sufi mystic on the other side, Saladin riding to victory. Here are a couple of defeated Westerners training behind him. My equestrian friends say the horse's tail is lifted, it's going to relax onto the defeated Westerners. So there you have, you know, a very clear sort of symbol of what's going to happen. Perhaps more interestingly, this is obviously Bashar. This is just in a back street of Damascus in the market. And actually when I was there last, there was, you know, again, sort of some roadside paintings of Bashar and Saladin. I wish to God I'd taken a picture of it. That has gone, or I ain't going to be getting back to take that picture anytime soon. But just these sort of images around of sort of horsemen riding to victory against the West are just, in some ways, that's more interesting than some of the other ones, because it's commonplace. Likewise, Saddam Hussein, ignoring the fact Saladin was a Kurd, don't tell the boss. Again, buttressing the Saddam thing, Saladin is part of the Iraqi national curriculum since the 1930s. So Saddam was educated in Saladin because he was there in the national curriculum. This is obviously Saladin's tanks, Saddam's tanks and Saladin's horsemen riding to victory against the West. Again, another sort of good image, which I'm afraid I haven't got, is a bath mat of Saladin and Saddam. And it's brilliant because it's utterly mundane. You know, it must have been thousands of these things produced. I haven't found one on eBay yet. But, you know, just a grotty bath mat, which I think the sort of how banal it is, that makes the point. You don't need to explain it. It's there. So, of course, it's not just Arab nationalism. It's Islamism as well. And bin Laden talked about the Crusades a lot, particularly after Bush. He does refer to Saladin a bit, but it's more broadly the Crusaders as a sort of wider idea. And then, yeah, this is just another everyday thing. This is a school in Jerusalem, and you walk through the door, it's the Caliph Umar on the left, and that's Saladin there on the right. That's just what you see every day in school there. So I suppose to sort of draw this together, the point that I've been trying to make is that, first of all, the history of the Crusades and the Near East, while does have a long, long lasting resonance. And in a sense, it's understanding the variations and the survival of that word is the thing that I'm interested in looking at. And I think it's something that we need to be aware of. It's interesting how it has survived in the West. Its revival in the 19th century, its noble cause, chivalric, very sort of secular kind of memory. Although not ignoring the fact that in things like World War I, it was invoked in a military situation. Eisenhower talked about the D-Day landings as a crusade. It's there on the memorial in Washington as well. So it has been used in military situations, but is largely in a sort of more secular sense. In the Near East, however, I think contrary to the previous kind of academic position, you can certainly trace the memory of Saladin and the Crusades from the medieval period down to the modern period. In the case of Saladin, not just as the man who defeated the Westerners and threw them out, but also as a man of authority, a man of generosity, a man to be admired as a great ruler. But also this legacy of Westerners coming in, taking land and killing Muslims. And I think that is something that does stretch back to certainly the 16th, 17th century. And it's something that perhaps needs to be understood more clearly when you're looking at the references to it in the 20th and the 21st century. Thank you very much.